You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, new research from the UW-Madison's Applied Population Lab is looking at the lasting effects of redlining in Milwaukee. We'll find out how the impacts are still being felt. First, a new survey of workers in the Milwaukee area is giving us an idea of their attitudes towards sexual harassment in the workplace. It was conducted by Tempo Milwaukee, a professional networking group for women who hold leadership positions, and it found that the vast majority of men and women have talked about the Me Too movement in the past year, that males' perceptions of sexual harassment have changed, and that about half of those surveyed have adjusted their behaviors around the opposite sex out of concerns of being accused of sexual harassment. Tempo says the results, while not scientific, show that more can be done to promote discussion of Me Too issues between men and women. And what do you think? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Has your workplace changed with regard to sexual harassment during the Me Too era? Have you changed your own behavior at work out of concerns of not knowing what's okay and what's not? Have you talked about the Me Too movement with your boss, employees, or coworkers? Or has your workplace changed any policies in the wake of Me Too? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jennifer Dirks is the president and CEO of Tempo Milwaukee, and she joins us from our Milwaukee studios. Jen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Judith. Thank you for having me, and thank you for providing another platform to really continue this important conversation on the Me Too movement.
Well, I don't want to get too bogged down in the mechanics of the survey, but since it's not scientific, give us a general idea of how this survey worked and on what you're basing the results.
Sure. So this was really a second iteration of the or in response to the first survey that we put out about a year ago when the Me Too movement was really making and capturing headlines across the nation. We put out our first survey and surveyed our Tempo Milwaukee members on their reactions to the Me Too movement in the workplace. And I think it was important with the second iteration of the survey that we provided a perspective, a one-year retrospective of what had happened since the Me Too movement, and really providing a voice for men. So we partnered with a couple of different organizations here in Milwaukee to help provide that male perspective. The other part of the first survey that we really looked at was this 34% of our members that took the survey, the first survey, reported that they believed, 34% of them believed that there would be unintended consequences to the Me Too movement. And so this survey really validated that belief. And we believed it was important to have both genders really provide their voice.
And let's dig into those unintended consequences. What kind of things were you hearing from the people who took the survey? Let's start perhaps with the men, as you said.
Yeah. So I think one of the biggest findings that we had, and I'm going to really focus on maybe four key findings of the survey in general. The first one that I pulled from was sexual harassment is less prevalent in the workplace. 36% of the women that took the survey, 50% of men said that this was the case. I believe that that stems from a lot more education, a greater awareness of the Me Too movement. And companies are really looking at putting sexual harassment policies in place. The second key finding was sexual harassment is still a topic that is being discussed among both sexes. So 97% of women and 83% of men felt this way. And then, you know, you had talked about kind of the perceptions that have changed for better and for worse, according to the survey. Men reported that they are more aware, they're more empathetic, they're more sensitive to women in the workplace. And then still, you know, we found that many men are feeling a bit more anxious, possibly, and cautious with their interactions with females. How would their interactions be perceived? And then the final one, which I think that we really want to focus on and you had alluded to, was the survey about the unintended consequences of the Me Too movement, and both positive and negative. So if you look at the negative, most men that took our survey acknowledge this idea around guilty until proven innocent mentality and this exclusion of women because of potential consequences or backlash.
And so exclusion of women in what sense? Are we talking socially, professionally, both?
Yeah. So it was from this perspective, it was really professionally in the workplace. And men and women also talked about feeling alienated. And I think that was one of the biggest surprises for me personally, that and a concern that if women are feeling alienated and that men are adjusting their behavior or avoiding women altogether because of their nervousness or their cautiousness about the unintended consequences.
And I want to go back to something that you said, Jen. You said that men and women are both talking a lot about Me Too, but who are they talking to?
Yeah, so this was an interesting statistic. So I had reported that 97% of women and the 83% of men say that sexual harassment is a topic that's being discussed. But among men, they're talking with their peers. They're not talking to women. And so we kind of tried to dig a little bit deeper and try and understand the why behind that. And what we found was that, and what the survey said, was that the stigma still exists and it's a taboo subject for men to approach with women. And they feel much more comfortable having that conversation with their male peers in the workplace.
We're talking with Jennifer Dirks right now. She's president and CEO of Tempo Milwaukee. And we're talking about a survey that that group did looking at sexual harassment policies and reactions in the wake of Me Too. And a listener on Facebook wrote, "I realized a lot more women and men in my circle of friends and family didn't care. They see reporting sexual harassment that didn't, quote, physically harm you as attention seeking and probably asked for it." She said, "It's disheartening. Apart from people who I know personally, it's really very sad to see role models, celebrities, politicians, etc., publicly speaking against the empowerment of the Me Too movement." So it sounds like there has been maybe more conversation about it, as this listener is saying, but not necessarily always a big shift in how people are viewing sexual harassment and what it is and what it's not.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think we kind of heard the same things. I think from a positive perspective for the consequences or, you know, the results of this from a women's perspective, and this listener alluded to that, was that women are feeling empowered and they are having the opportunity to speak out. But then we also heard from a majority of women that they were saying that men are feeling blamed and this shouldn't be a reflection on all men. And so I think that was one of the key results of this survey that we, took as, or that our members took as well.
Jen, did you get a sense from the responses to this survey how many companies or workplaces are being more vocal, are being not just assuming people know how to act, but laying out clearer policies so maybe people would feel a little more comfortable that they know what parameters are okay?
So one of the things that we heard from our organizations is they are, again, building greater awareness and education. I think there is a greater movement towards installing policies and procedures. I think there was even a gray area around what is the true definition of sexual harassment in the workplace. And I think there, from what we've heard and what we've seen with our survey results, is that more and more companies are having those conversations. There is a great deal of education. They're dusting off their old policies from, you know, the 80s or the 90s, and they're really bringing this to the forefront. And I think that's a positive movement for organizations in the Milwaukee area.
And as we start to wrap up, Jen, it's been 17 months since the first Harvey Weinstein accusations came out. You did a follow-up a year after that, and now this. What do you hope to see in the next year or a couple years on this issue of sexual harassment?
Yeah, so I think the one thing that we really find positive is, and you know, this is, again, providing a platform, but our second survey, our first survey, really helped to provide that dialogue and continue those conversations. I think that it is important for Tempo to not only represent the female voice in our community, but also, you know, what goes beyond that? How are we cascading that message to our employers? How are we taking that home and having those important conversations around the dinner table?
And we'll need to leave it there. Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us. Jennifer Dirks is the president and CEO of Tempo Milwaukee. They did a recent survey on sexual harassment in the workplace in the Me Too era, and she joined us from our Milwaukee studios. Coming up, a look at the impacts of redlining in Milwaukee. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, the U.S. Senate rejected the Green New Deal climate change proposal yesterday in a procedural vote meant to show divides in the Democratic caucus. We'll find out how things played out during our roundup of national politics. First, Milwaukee has been deemed one of the most segregated cities in the country. But when it comes to why that is, there isn't as many widely known facts. As an ongoing project from UW-Madison's Applied Population Lab is working to shed more light on how the now outlawed practice of redlining has shaped the city's neighborhoods and how people of color in the city still feel the effects of the policy today. Josh Garun is an assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. He's been contributing to the project. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Remind us what the practice of redlining is and was.
Right. So redlining gets its name from maps that were drawn up by the Homeowners Loan Corporation back in the late 1930s. And it gets its name from the fact that the maps were color-coded. So basically, this organization that was a quasi-governmental organization that comes about after a New Deal Housing Act, the Federal Housing Act 1934, commissions these maps to be drawn up of major cities throughout the country. And the idea of these maps is to determine which parts of which cities, which neighborhoods, are good risks for insured mortgages. And this is because the country is trying to push more mortgages out there. They're responding to people not being able to afford housing, not being able to afford homeownership. So what these maps do is they get realtors, typically local realtors, who go out, they look at the neighborhoods, they come up with neighborhood descriptions. On the basis of those descriptions and the data they collect in those descriptions, they assign a color to each part of the city. And the best areas were green, that was type A, and then you had blue, which was type B, and then you had yellow, which was type C, and then type D is red. And the type D areas were the parts of the cities where the HLC's maps were suggesting to people who were going to be extending these mortgages, don't extend credit there, don't give loans there. And because they were red, because they were these blocks of the city, this practice became known as redlining. And in terms of what the effects of this were, you have to look at who typically lived in these redlined areas. And effectively, if there was any significant population of African Americans, of Black people living in these areas, they were redlined.
So let's back up just a little bit. So sure. We have the green, blue, yellow, and red. So these realtors would go out, they would make their assessment of a neighborhood. What would a neighborhood look like that was, for instance, marked as green?
Right. So it's going to vary a little bit by geography, depending on what the local context was, socially, politically, culturally. But typically, it's white. Typically, it's whites of a certain sort. So, for example, in Madison, Italians were not white. So Greenbush, the old Greenbush, the Greenbush Triangle is redlined, actually, because there are too many Italians living there, too many Jews and some African Americans. But if you had Scandinavians and Germans and they were relatively wealthy and the housing stock was in good condition, then that would be a good way for you to have a green or a blue neighborhood. Also, if there was no sense from the realtor that there was a pressure or influx of undesirable people, right?
And it sounds like those undesirables were often the most recent immigrants, because certainly Germans were immigrants, but they tended to come in earlier waves than, say, the Italians.
Exactly. And of course, those ethnic tensions are what's informing the realtors to begin with. If you have people coming in from these ethnic groups who are more dug into the city and who are from those ethnic groups and also in the professional classes, you get this reproduction at the time of the biases, the discrimination, which races, which ethnic groups were desirable and which were unhealthy, which would make a neighborhood go on the decline. And that would lead to a yellow or a redlined area. Some of it has to do with geography in the city, too. It's not like this was 100% based on race and ethnicity, the history of the neighborhood, its proximity to amenities, how close it was to industrial areas or to other parts of the city all played a role. And this is all reflected in those neighborhood descriptions that were generated. But the maps really become the encapsulation of that, because whether someone was going to read through all these neighborhood descriptions to say, oh, do I really believe this is a redlined area, is questionable. And in fact, there's pretty good research, including a paper from three economists at the Federal Reserve of Chicago, showing that these redlining maps didn't only capture the existing reality, but structured it going forward, that you can actually see causally the way these maps become reality as mortgages and credit follow what is drawn out here.
This map construction and coloring, I guess we can say, seems like an enormous undertaking, even if we're only looking at pretty major urban areas. Were they ever revised after that first wave of descriptions?
So there's a big debate among historians and others about how much these maps were actually used. They were originally intended for internal use, but depending on whose narrative you follow, they leaked out or they were distributed and people got hold of them. And then people started drawing up their own. So private corporations, banks would draw up their own maps along these lines because it seemed like a good idea. It seemed like a good idea, a good way to capture risk and decide.
I was going to say, I'm sure they portrayed it as risk assessment.
That's exactly what they're doing. You know, they're not denying why they're assessing these risks. And at the time, you know, there is some popular opinion to support the, oh, that's risky. Those people are undesirable. You know, this is before really white flight starts taking place. This is what leads to, in many ways, white flight once neighborhoods start experiencing the disinvestment in certain parts of the neighborhood. And of course, Black people are not passive in the face of this. They're trying to figure out how they can either get out of the redlined areas or figure out other ways around it. And in fact, you start seeing some of the early waves of what could be a precursor to predatory lending. And in the 1960s, once this practice is outlawed and into the 70s, you actually see what's called reverse redlining, where because banks can no longer discriminate in the way they were doing on the basis of these maps, you actually get the first waves of predatory mortgages where they're charging more money to Black people, or they're giving them worse loans, or the insurance or other riders on the mortgage are more punitive, such that Black people are now able to get credit in a way that they weren't with the redlining maps. But it's punitive credit in many ways. It's credit that makes homeownership incredibly risky for them in a way it's not for white people. And the other corollary that is, like I said, this is New Deal era legislation that leads to the creation of the HOLC, where the maps come from. And what the government is doing at the same time is encouraging white people to buy homes, to take out mortgages, and also subsidizing the suburbs. And there's great historical literature on the way the government builds the suburbs up, coaxes white people into the suburbs, gives them these mortgages that are just not available to Black people, who get more or less stuck in place. Patrick Sharkey's written a book that literally titled, and they wind up not being able to get out, not least because they haven't been able to accumulate the wealth, the equity in their homes, because they can't get mortgages. There's disinvestment, the property values fall, the housing stock falls, and you get this vicious cycle whereby, even in the absence of redlining after 1968 when the practice is outlawed, there are other forms of redlining or reverse redlining that come in. And that's what the article in WisContext is really speaking to, is the way that this 1930s, 40s era practice can be used to see what we've experienced since then and up to the present day in places like Milwaukee.
We're talking with Josh Garoon. He's an assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. And we're talking about a recent look by our colleagues at WisContext at the continuing impacts of redlining, especially in Milwaukee. And Josh, you kind of foreshadowed that there. So it's been over 50 years since redlining was made illegal. But looking at demographic maps of Milwaukee, there's still a very strong correlation. What do you see when you look at those?
Right. So when you look at those maps, what you see is that if you look at what's called a racial dot map, where there's a dot for every certain number of people, maybe 50 people who are categorized in a certain racial or ethnic category, and you make different colors of those for Black people, for people who are Latinx, for people who are white, for people who are generically, unfortunately, Asian, you see that people of color, especially Black people and especially Latin people in Milwaukee, you see that they are bunched in areas that were redlined and to some extent yellow lined. So these type C and D areas back in the late 1930s. And so there is a continuation today of the racial residential segregation, not because these redlining maps are still being used, because again, that use is supposed to be illegal, but because you have this persistence over time, and because you have these practices that replace the formal mapped redlining over the duration, whether it's you know, from the 40s on. 1949, there's a new housing act that comes online with Truman under the Fair Deal. That's the big urban renewal funding act, that really one of the first of its kind. And that's when you start seeing money flowing into these redlined areas to demolish them.
And briefly, as we wrap up, are there any positive ways to eliminate this ongoing effect of redlining?
So there are. You know, this is a big part of the question around affordable housing. It's been a big part of questions about studies like Moving to Opportunity, which is a big national study that actually tried to give people vouchers to get them away from these neighborhoods that were historically disadvantaged, especially into upper-income neighborhoods, not just to any neighborhood, but specifically to upper-income neighborhoods. There's been mixed success there, and the evaluations of that are ongoing. It looks like it takes multiple generations for these sorts of projects to really take off. But I should also say this is one of the central questions in the reparations debate today, which is not, as is sort of caught the buzz of cutting a check to people individually, but rather thinking more structurally about, okay, if we consider redlining as something that broke neighborhoods of color, that broke black neighborhoods, that broke black communities, is there a way to repair that by providing not just affordable housing, but looking more systematically at how we might invest in black neighborhoods, invest in black communities in ways that cut back against what was going on? And there's an ironic twist there because, of course, the 2007-2008 financial crisis had a reverse redlining aspect to it where black churches were recruited by banks into trying to push subprime mortgages. And now I think what we're seeing is can we try to use some of these same mechanisms through a reparative approach that would do the opposite of that and really start trying to repair all of this damage that's been done, not just since the 1930s before that, but really with redlining formalized in the 1930s.
Well, Josh, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Josh Garoon, assistant professor in UW-Madison's Department of Community and Environmental Sociology. He was with us to talk about a project he worked on with the UW-Madison's Applied Population Lab, looking at the effects of redlining in Milwaukee. You can find their latest piece and all of WisContext's work on disparities in Wisconsin online at wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, we'll check in on what's happening in the nation's capital, including where the focus of lawmakers and the president's is shifting to in the aftermath of the conclusion of the Mueller investigation. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a second judge has blocked some of the laws passed by state Republicans in a lame duck session late last year. We'll talk to our state capitol reporter about what this means and the legal fight ahead. First, we're taking a look at some of the week's top stories in national politics. An effort to override President Trump's veto of a resolution to block his national emergency declaration failed in the House. Lawmakers are reacting to the findings of the Mueller report, and the Senate chose not to take up the Green New Deal in a procedural vote held yesterday. And we want to know what you think about this vote on the Green New Deal. Is this something you want your representative or senators to support? Are lawmakers who oppose the resolution right in saying it's too ambitious, or does Congress need to be thinking big? What policies would you like to see, if any, to slow down climate change and its effects? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Eugene Scott is a reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post, where he covers identity politics. Eugene, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yesterday, as we said, the House failed to overturn President Trump's veto of a resolution to block his national emergency declaration, meaning that the declaration will stay in effect. Does that effectively put the issue to rest, or will we see other action on this?
Well, we're likely going to see other action, especially in terms of it moving towards the courts. This will not be the end of things from the Trump White House or Congress as they seek a resolution regarding what is legal and what is best in terms of responding to the president's ideals for a border wall. We know that there are at least 7 lawsuits right now that have been filed challenging the legality of Trump's emergency declaration and its plan to spend funds on the wall, you know, that have been appropriated by Congress for that purpose. But the dispute over the attempt it's just not going to end anytime soon and could take years to, quite frankly, get to the bottom of.
A lot of issues in recent times have gone on strict party votes. In this case, 13 House Republicans and 12 Senate Republicans voted for the resolution to block his emergency declaration. What are we hearing from those Republicans who are voting against the administration?
Well, I think many people have failed to realize that despite how popular Trump's idea is with his base, that there are people in the Republican Party, which is larger than Trump's base, who push back on the use of these funds set aside for military projects to be diverted to this wall because they don't believe that it is an emergency. And many of these lawmakers, quite frankly, are along the border representing districts in states that have been aware of these issues for far longer than the president has been in politics. And so their pushback is rooted in knowledge and policy and data and context, not as much as in partisanship.
President Trump makes a point of valuing loyalty and coming out against people who he feels are not being loyal to him and his agenda. Has he said anything about those Republicans that voted against him?
Not yet. He hasn't really focused his attention on this matter, I think, knowing that it's not a done deal and that at the end of the day, he may be able to get what he wants. But I think we can expect some type of retaliation from the president as we move towards the 2020 election and some of these lawmakers find themselves having to compete for their seats again if the president latches on to a candidate who he believes will be more consistent in backing his ideals and proposals. I can see him certainly endorsing them in a primary against an incumbent of his own party.
Which we have seen him do in the past.
We have.
And Eugene, do you think that there's any interest in Congress in putting some limits on any president's powers to declare national emergencies? A lot of the opponents to this have said this is not an emergency. There is not an emergency on the border.
I don't know if we have seen any lawmakers say that they want a limit on the number of national emergencies that a president can declare. But there's certainly been a very clear communication coming from both sides of the aisle about what an emergency is and is not. And making that case to Trump has been a priority for quite a few lawmakers, but also to the American public so that they can have an idea of what leadership should be doing in terms of trying to get their agendas passed and supported and what they should not be doing. And quite a few lawmakers don't think that this approach is the most effective.
So the National Emergency Declaration is staying in place. The border security issue is not going away anytime soon. Eugene, what will you be watching for in next steps from the White House or from Congress?
I'm very interested in seeing how the White House makes its case before the courts, trying to prove that this is, in fact, an emergency and that these funds need to be diverted from existing projects that have already been allocated for because this is such an emergency. I'm also waiting, like most people, to figure out which projects will not be getting their funding immediately or eventually because of this wall. And so we can have a better idea of what the president considers this wall to be more of an emergency than.
We're talking with Eugene Scott right now. He's a reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post. And we're talking about some of the biggest news stories out of Washington this week. And Eugene, let's move on to the Green New Deal vote. First, can you summarize for us what is in this Green New Deal? I know there are a lot of parts, but in general, what does it want to do?
Well, what the Green New Deal wants to do is to reduce America's dependence on fossil fuels in response to climate change. And there, what that entails is pretty broad, depending on who you're listening to. There's certainly desires to get guaranteed job security for all Americans and green-friendly employment. And just also to respond to our greenhouse gas emissions and get it to zero while guaranteeing Americans also high-quality health care. And so it was pretty far-reaching in its ambitions, also trying to encourage Americans to use transportation differently vehicles, should we say, and trains and planes that are better for the environment. And so the details of it are not as clear as many supporters or even critics would like. And that perhaps is set it up for a lot of criticism from those on the right.
So Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell held a procedural vote yesterday on the Green New Deal. It didn't pass. McConnell is far from a supporter of this proposal. So what was his aim in having the Senate vote on it?
Well, initially, I think the perception was that he wanted to show just how divided the Democratic Party is on the matter. We know that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been in the forefront of getting the Green Deal passed and supported by the public. But the reality is Democrats in the party who are more conservative have not been as enthusiastic about this new deal as presented. And I think McConnell wanted to expose the left as not being as united on this matter as maybe some would hope, in part because quite a bit of attention in this current political climate has been on just how divided the GOP is on a host of policy issues, including climate change.
And how did Democratic senators respond to this?
Well, some, about four, I believe, voted along with Republicans opposing the Green New Deal. But the majority of Democrats just voted present, did not want to make any clear stance, including some who we know have come out in support of the Green New Deal, you know, on Twitter or in stump speeches or elsewhere. But they certainly want to work within their own caucus to get something that is more palatable to the American people before being exposed by the GOP as backing something that some Americans find a bit preposterous in some situations and just unrealistic in others.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And James in Scale Mounds is on the line. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What would you like to say?
Well, I'd just like to bring up, I know they talk about there's a lot of difference in the political will for the thing like the Green New Deal, but I wish that both parties would just address the science of the fact that achieving anything close to what it was presenting is basically scientifically impossible unless by some miracle the world at whole somehow comes up with technology that can be implemented in such a fast fashion. We all depend on fossil fuels to a huge extent to put our way of life the way it is over 150 years ago, and I don't know if people just don't realize it or just don't care to realize it, but it's not going to be nearly as easy as politics being on the same page.
All right. Thanks for that call, James. And let's go right to Fawn in Madison. Hi, Fawn. I don't think we have Fawn.
Well, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Yeah, I believe that the Green New Deal ought to be absolutely discussed, promoted, and receive the full support by all the Democrats and by those Republicans who understand what what is up. And many of them have actually come to see that there are benefits to it, and that there are so many parts of it that will benefit their constituents. The majority of people support the Green New Deal when they understand what is in it. It supports jobs. It will be great for jobs in the United States, that will jobs that cannot be sent overseas, that will not expire, they're not vulnerable to the scarcity of resources such as fossil fuels, and that will absolutely benefit not only our economy and the stability of our economy now that we have the technology to make this happen, and that solar and renewables are actually becoming cheaper than fossil fuels, as we're seeing, but also that it will be instrumental to the survival of us as a species.
Thanks for that call, Fawn. So a couple of different perspectives there, Eugene.
Absolutely. I think what Democrats on the left and the more far left of the party are hoping to do in reference to the first caller is to just be as ambitious as possible, knowing that the way lawmaking works is that it's not likely that they will get everything that they want passed. And so you just shoot for the sky, for the moon, with the hope that you can find a middle ground that you are more acceptable, that you find more acceptable and more pleased with implementing. And so it is worth noting, though, to the second caller's point, that we have seen a few Republican lawmakers come out and admit, including Mitch McConnell, that they do believe that the science supports that climate change is real, that humans are playing a factor into creating that, and that some changes need to be made.
Following the vote in the Senate, Wisconsin Republican Representative Sean Duffy suggested that the Green New Deal was more of an elite concern. Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a co-sponsor of the Green New Deal, had this to say in response.
This is about our constituents and all of our lives. Iowa, Nebraska, broad swaths of the Midwest are drowning right now, underwater. Farms, towns that will never be recovered and never come back. And we're here, and people are more concerned about helping oil companies than helping their own families? I don't think so. I don't think so.
So has there been a lot of discussion in Congress, Eugene, about who actually ends up bearing the heaviest burden of a changing climate?
Not in terms of, big major cities on the coast versus the heartland. There's been, I think, a push among those on the left, as you just saw from the representative, to communicate to the American people who are not on the coast of how climate change affects their daily lives, and how this is something that is not just benefiting elites in major cities, but that we do see issues related to natural disasters devastating communities in what are generally called the red states or the flyover states that can be changed with some policy initiatives and resources, decisions made about how we consume energy and how we use transportation that could lead to some change. And so it's a national concern, and that's why you see even lawmakers from states that are not on the coast finally acknowledging that.
We're talking with Eugene Scott right now, a reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post, and we're breaking down some of the big news stories from the nation's capital this week. And there's still time for you to weigh in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the New Deal, Green New Deal? Why or why not? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation after a short break here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Eugene Scott of The Washington Post, looking at a few of the week's big stories in national politics. And Eugene, I want to make sure that we touch on the aftermath of the Mueller report being finished and submitted. It was after about 2 years of watching, waiting, and reporting. What has the mood been in Washington since that news came down?
Well, it obviously has been divided among party lines for the most part. Democrats have been very vocal, making it clear to people that we have not seen the Mueller report. We have seen Bill Barr's report of the Mueller report. And there's definitely a desire, of course, to make that public, at the very least to Congress, if not to the American people as a whole. And there's a need for liberal lawmakers, according to them, to get a better idea of why Mueller decided not to conclude that the president had, in fact, obstructed justice, and what he wanted to be done with his decision not to make a decision. Those on the right, especially those most supportive of the president, have interpreted the report as a vindication for the president that he, in fact, or his campaign, should we say, did not collude with the Russian government to win the 2016 election. And so they certainly are hoping to, campaign on that with the idea of attacking Democrats and even the media for focusing so much on this story that, quite frankly, has cast a cloud over his victory for more than 2 years.
Representative Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, has been one of the most vocal proponents of making the report public. Here he is speaking on ABC this week.
And I think, frankly, the country owes Bob Mueller a debt of gratitude for conducting the investigation as professionally as he has. So I have trust in his prosecutorial judgment, but that doesn't mean, of course, that there isn't compelling and incriminating evidence that should be shared with the American people.
Schiff is suggesting that there's still incriminating information to be seen. Are we hearing that from other Democrats, or is he something of an outlier at this point?
Well, he's certainly not an outlier. He's definitely received the support of other Democrats who would like to see other investigations into individuals affiliated with Trump and organizations like the Trump Corporation continue. I think that will be the norm until the Mueller report becomes public, because there's a belief that there could be information in the report that will support Schiff's view of what happened between the Trump campaign and Russia.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi has already come out against the idea of impeaching the president. Will the Mueller report effectively end talk of impeachment from other Democrats in Congress?
Probably not. I think it's really important for folks to remember that the president was deemed unfit for reasons, quite frankly, other than the belief that he or his team may have actively colluded with the Russian government. And I think we have a piece in today's Washington Post written by George Conway, the husband of the White House counselor Kellyanne Conway, talking about how difficult it is to actually define and determine collusion in and of itself. And so it's possible to many people on both sides of the aisle that there was some inappropriate contact between the campaign and those in Russia hoping to interfere in the election of our president in 2016. And that's, in fact, why you had so many people in the campaign plead guilty to lying very often about their interaction with Russians. But beyond that, the unfitness of the president, based on his policies and his worldview, his temperament and behavior, and other actions, have made many among the base believe that he is unfit for the office and perhaps will want to look in ways to remove him from the office.
Well, Eugene, thank you so much for joining us today and bringing us up to speed on all of this news.
Very glad to be here.
Eugene Scott is a reporter for The Fix at The Washington Post, where he covers identity politics. He was with us for our weekly look at some of the top ongoing stories in Congress and the White House. And we will be hoping to cover the media response to the Mueller investigation and report, talking about what expectations were set up and whether the media was responsible in its coverage. You can still send us your thoughts on what we've been discussing today. What's your reaction to the Senate voting down the Green New Deal yesterday? What kind of legislation would you like to see on climate change, if any? And now that the Mueller report is finished, what issues do you want to see lawmakers turn their attention to? You can let us know by emailing ideas@WPR.org. You can also send us a message on Twitter. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, and you can also comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We always want to hear what you'd like to hear about. Coming up later in the show, we are going to be asking you for ideas of great back roads around Wisconsin that you can take road trips on this spring. If you're itching to get out on the road but don't necessarily need a destination, it'll be a great conversation for places to go and sights to see as you meander around the back roads of Wisconsin. That's coming up a little later on the show, right here on Central Time. It may be hard to believe that April is right around the corner, but it is. And that means that next Tuesday, April 2nd, is Election Day. Spring elections often see much lower turnout than fall elections, but that doesn't mean they're any less important. There are many municipal elections, from mayors to city and town council seats to school board members, that will be happening. And there's also a statewide election for a Supreme Court justice. If you need some help to feel informed, we've got you covered. WisconsinVote.org is your source for election news and information. There you can find your polling place, you can register to vote, you can view your sample ballot so you know what races to research, you can read candidate profiles, and you can listen to archived interviews and news stories with and about candidates. That's all at WisconsinVote.org. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk about the latest developments in the legal fight over laws passed last year by Republicans that curbed the power of Governor Tony Evers and Attorney General Josh Call. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.